cars in the driveway. The garage is full of junk. It'll take me a week to clean it, but by then I'll still be drunk. I got the blues. Oh, the homeowner blues.
Well, man's home is his castle. This one's just a hassle.
Homeowner blues.
Hello, friends, and welcome to this, the Homeowner's Friend Podcast, the podcast that will help you achieve the American dream and live the best life you can, even on a rice and beans budget. We're going to move forward today into heating and cooling your home, specifically heating. We're going to talk about the two main types of heating systems, be it hot air and water-based systems. Before I get into that, though, I wanted to fill you in that we're going to have some more electrical stuff coming up. I have a gentleman that wants to come on the show, probably. I've got to contact him. I think it's going to be okay. So I'm kind of going out on a limb here. I think we'll be able to get him on the show to talk about solar energy. So when that happens, I'm going to, I'll incorporate that into the show, obviously. And I have another fellow that wants to come on and talk about geothermal energy as well. So we'll, you know, which is basically heating and cooling your home as well. So I'm going to try and get those scheduled. It's kind of difficult because usually they want to do the interviews during the day, which is when I work. So I'm going to have to do some finagling here, but we'll see what we can do. So getting right into our topic, we'll start with heating. There's two main ways, in a couple subcategories, two main ways to heat your house. And one is with a hot air system. And one is with hydronics or water-based systems, you know, radiators or the radiant, you know, in-floor type or those kinds of systems. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both. And I've lived in houses with both, so I have a fair amount of experience in both systems. And do I have a favorite? I don't know. I've lived in houses with both, and I would say that, you know, when I grew up in the 1960s ranch with a very old crappy furnace. It was a small house. It was like a 700-800 foot ranch, and it had an oil-fired heating system. And the house, of course, you know, by the time I got older, the house was already pretty old, and the furnace was pretty much an old piece of junk. Be quite honest with you, it was actually a Grossman's furnace, made by Grossman's. If you remember Grossman's, they were an old, pre Home Depot type, home and building store. I don't know when they went out of business. I guess they went out of business I guess they were still open when I was building my house in Vermont. So, and they closed during that process. So I think they closed probably, I'm gonna say, early '90s. I think they went belly up, something like that. But anyway, they used to, actually, the whole house, kind of an interesting story. It's actually a Grossman's house. You used to be able to buy from Grossman's a house. And they would deliver all the pieces and parts you needed to build a house. It was a basic, you know, this was a raised ranch, a very basic raised ranch. And they gave you all the wood you needed for it. You know, not the foundation, obviously, but you got all the wood, you know, enough wood to build the house. You got the interior doors. I think they even gave you the interior paneling. It was all paneling back then. Everything came kind of in a big kit, and then you just put the thing together. And I guess part of the kit included the furnace. I don't know all the details, but this is kind of what I was told. I don't know if it's true or not, but it was actually the furnace, and it actually said Grossman's on it. So I can imagine that's exactly what happened. Is it came with the house, and I bet you the ductwork and everything else came with it as well. It's kind of an interesting way to do it. They don't really do that anymore that way. You know, where you get all the parts. I guess probably. Some companies probably do it somewhere, but it's not as popular. But anyway, I used to detest that system for a couple reasons. One is it was very, very dusty. And I think that was just because it was 30 years old. I mean, it was just an old, junky system. It had the most basic filter in it. And, my father was, he's still around. You know, he was kind of cheap, so I don't know how often... He probably didn't change the filters as much as he could. But, the return ducts, I'm sure, were just filled with dust. I mean, there was no such thing as duct cleaning when I was a kid. You know, it was 20 years ago. So, I think, you know, it was just the system was just dirty, and it was just blew a lot of dust, and that was kind of annoying. And the other thing is, when the thing kicked in, it you know, blew a lot of heat, and it really made the room warm, hot almost, and then the thing would shut off, and shortly thereafter, you'd be freezing. So it was very uneven heat, and I just didn't like it. It gave me a very bad, you know, I just hated warm air heat at that point. And when I built the house in Vermont, the log home, I put baseboard in that, because I've known people with baseboard heat, and I've stayed in houses with baseboard heat for short periods anyway. I never really lived in one before that, but I just really liked it. So I went with baseboard, and it was wonderful. And then I built, we built the house that we had before this one in Connecticut. And that one there, we went with baseboard as well. Then we had air conditioning put in it as well, up in the attic, a separate system. And this house that we have now, I was up against it in budget. This one here, I ended up going back with warm air, believe it or not. But I was sold on the new systems and how high-tech they are and how efficient they are. And that they're just much better than the old ones. So I ended up going with hot air. So I've kind of been through the whole circle. And, you know, at this point, I guess if I had to choose... I guess it would depend where I lived. If I was in Vermont again, I would probably still go with baseboard, because heating's a big thing up there. It gets very wicked cold, and it's cold all the time, and you don't really need air conditioning in the summer up there, because it doesn't really get hot. You can stick a window unit in the house, and it does the whole house. I mean, you get a couple weeks of 90-degree weather. It's not a big deal. In Connecticut, however, you really need central, because it's just miserable here in the summer. Though this summer, we didn't even have a summer. But generally, it's miserable here in the summer. I mean, it's 90 and humid for, you know, weeks on end. So it's just, you know, all of August and, you know, a lot of July and all of August is usually just miserable. I mean, it's been miserable until recently. So you need the air. So if you need, you know, if you need air conditioning, central air, then it makes sense to go with a warm air system, because you're already putting in the whole air handling bit with the heater. So you're saving that money. If you go with baseboard, you still got to put the air handler in on top of it. So it costs an extra, you know, I mean, I would say it's probably at least an extra, I mean, it depends on if you're doing some of the work yourself or not, but at least an extra $5,000 and maybe $10,000 more to have a separate air conditioner, air handler, you know, in the attic, and then have the baseboard. Plus, you got to put the baseboard in, which is very expensive too. So I think, you know, from a budget to strictly budgetary standpoint, if you need both, you're probably better off with hot air. But if you if you're in an area where heating is your main thing you're going to be doing, and again, cooling's not such a big deal, you know, I think baseboard is perhaps the way to go. So, you know, having said that, let me just get into kind of the two different systems and the ups and downs and a little bit of how they work. And again, I'm not going to get into the fuels because I want to, you know, I might talk a little bit about it, but generally I want to be able to give you some statistics which will kind of open your eyes to the different fuels and, you know, why you should maybe choose one over the other. So, see, should I start with hot air or hot water? Let's start with hot water. In the old days, the systems were primarily steam systems. It's not really hot water, it's more hot steam, but they're very similar. And what would happen is you'd have the big old boiler in the basement, and it was actually called a boiler because you were boiling water to make steam. And the boiler would make the steam, and it would go out a big pipe on the top of the boiler, and it would be distributed through all the radiators, where the steam would cool and condense, and then be typically another pipe going back to the furnace where the condensed water would come back. And so it was typically a loop. You could have a couple different systems. Sometimes it was like a two-pipe system, and sometimes it was a one-pipe system. And what I mean by that is, like, if it was a one-floor house, for example, sometimes there would be two pipes going around the outside edge, and sometimes there would only be one. And in fact, I think with steam, there generally was a one-pipe system. And what they had at each fixture, they had basically a little scoop installed in the pipe. So the steam would come rushing by, and the little scoop would kind of scoop some of it off and bring it up into that radiator, and the rest of it would continue on the pipe. And at the other end of the radiator, there'd be a return that would dump the water back into the pipe on the other side. So each radiator would bleed off a little bit of that steam and use it to heat itself up and condense back down again. And that loop actually went around the basement and then made its way back into the furnace. And it probably had a downward tilt the whole way. So as water poured back into the pipe, it would drizzle back down into the furnace. I don't know all the details. I've never worked on a steam system, but this is what I've been told and the little limited experience I've had. So it's a whole different beast. Now, steam systems are great, but they're not terribly efficient. For the main reason that most of the steam systems had those big old radiators, which are just absolutely wonderful. I love those radiators. There's nothing nicer than being in a room in a cold winter's day and having a nice warm radiator sitting there throwing heat out all the time. It's just so nice. But so inefficient. And why is it inefficient? Well, you got about you got hundreds of pounds of mass there, which is what's nice about them, because they take a long time to heat up, and then a long time to cool off. So they give a nice even heat to the room. They're slow to heat up and slow to cool off. So the room's always kind of the same temperature, and it's kind of nice. The problem is, if they're not sized exactly right, you'll end up with a room that, you know, you end up overheating the room. And there's just so much mass in these things that it just takes a lot of BTUs to warm them up. So on a spring day, if you want a little bit of heat, you got to heat that whole radiator up, but it's too much heat. You know, maybe in the dead of winter it's okay, but in the springtime or in the fall, it's just too much. So that's one problem. Hold on a second, I'm in traffic. Okay, there we go. I was fighting traffic. So it's just a lot to heat up. And the other thing is, when you went down to these boilers, and you looked at these boilers, and I'm sure a lot of you have seen them, especially if you live in the north. These things were massive. They were no lie, the things were 2 to 2 feet wide. And probably 4 to 5 feet high in many cases. And some of them I've seen 6 feet long. I mean, these massive, big, heavy cast iron monsters. And a lot of them were old coal-fired or wood-fired, coal-fired generally, boilers that were converted to oil. You know, they would take the door that, you know, you used to open the door up and throw wood in. They would basically bolt an oil burner to the thing. They were converted. So you'd burn oil to heat this thing up. You know, when oil was a nickel a gallon, it was no big deal. But when oil gets expensive, it takes, you know, a gallon of oil just to warm those damn things up. I mean, it's ridiculous. They're so big. And you got to heat up all those radiators. And, you know, you're burning an incredible amount of oil just to get the system heated up to heat the house. And then you heat the house, and then the thing's hot, and it's staying hot forever, and it's overheating the house. And they're just not very efficient. Very comfortable, but not very efficient. And I think today, we need efficiency more than anything else. Although comfort's fine nowadays too. But I mean, those were just really neat systems. But it's so damn inefficient. You just can't do it. Now we rely on technology and not brute force to be comfortable. And it's more efficient to do so. So then they started slowly swapping over starting to put in hot water systems. And a hot water system is, I guess it's more efficient than steam. I don't know which is better or worse, but nobody puts steam systems in anymore, so it's pretty much a moot point to even talk about them other than just to briefly cover them. But hot water systems are a little different in that they all have a loop. It's always a closed loop where there's the hot water comes out of the boiler, and it goes out through the loop through some radiators and back into the furnace. There's never these little scoop valves or anything like that. What you may have is kind of one line going out and then various radiators coming off it kind of in parallel that can even in some cases be turned on and off individually depending on the zones and things like that, and we'll talk about that. But there's always a loop of some sort, and sometimes there's some parallel loops within those loops, but there's always one path out of the boiler and back in again. And the systems now are much smaller. the baseboards that are in your home are really nothing more. A modern baseboard is really nothing more than a 3/4-inch piece of copper pipe. That's all it is. And there's fins, like welded or crimped or welded to that copper pipe. And it's in that little, you know, little stamped steel case that makes it look pretty. That's all it is. It's a piece of pipe. So there's really no mass to it at all. There's a copper pipe which heats up very quickly and cools off very quickly, and you have the fins to get that heat out of the water inside the pipe. That's it. There's no big 200-pound cast iron radiator to heat up. So you know, in a whole house, I mean, I don't know what the numbers that I'm pulling this out of my hat, but there might be, you know, 20 gallons of water, 15, 20 gallons of water in all of the loops through the whole house. You know, it might be only 5. I don't know. It might be probably closer to 5 gallons. It doesn't take much to fill up a piece of 3/4-inch pipe. So whatever it is, a couple gallons, 5 gallons. Those old radiators were probably 5 to 10 gallons a piece in those things. So, you know, you can see the difference. It's just a much smaller amount of water. And as time's gone on now, the boilers themselves have gotten much smaller as well. And in fact, you can get boilers now that have absolutely no storage at all, and we'll talk about those. But most of your boilers now, even your kind of old-fashioned type boilers, like your Burnham boilers, that, you know, the standard cast iron boilers, which are great boilers. I had one in Vermont. Those don't take that. They do have some storage of water in them. They have a water jacket, but it might be 5 or 8 gallons. That's it. It's not that much water. Compared to these old monsters that would have, you know, I don't know, maybe 100 gallons in there. And in addition to that, you know, many gallons of water in the boiler, you had all the water in the radiators too. So it was just a huge amount of water to warm up. Today's boilers, like I say, there might be a few gallons of water in your standard boiler. There's a boiler called the System 2000, which is a very, very, very efficient boiler that has some water in it. I think the thing's got like 2 or 3 gallons of water in it. It doesn't take much at all to heat that water up. It's very quick to heat the water up. So very inefficient. If you need just a little bit of heat in the house in the spring and in the fall, and even in the winter, you know, as you insulate your house more and more, you need less and less heat to heat it up, really. You know, so, and you don't want to overheat the house because that's a waste. You want to heat the house up just to a point where it's warm, and then you want the thing to shut off. So these low-mass boilers and low-mass loops do that, and that because of that, it's a lot more efficient than it used to be. So, as I was saying, with your standard boiler, I'll just kind of go through some of the parts a little bit. This is just a standard, basic boiler. You have the boiler itself, which is just a big... it's a big box, holds water, and within the box there's a burner in a small area in there called the firebox, where the flames from the burner go, you know, are in the firebox. It's for like an oil fire. It actually has a little box that the flames shoot into, and I'll talk about gas in a second. It's a little different, and the flames shoot into the firebox. There's usually some like asbestos type material in there. I doubt it's asbestos anymore, but it's just a little insulation just to keep the cast iron from cracking from that extreme heat from that white hot fire. And then that heat immediately starts to go up through a bunch of cast iron heat exchangers. Basically, the Burnham I had basically had these, like, it kind of looked like an egg carton. You know, it had those, you know, you look at an egg carton, it's got the little things sticking up, the little nibs in it to keep the egg separated. The heat exchanger almost looked like that, but smaller. You'd have to have like miniature eggs. They have all these little bumps, and the heat would go through those bumps, and that would absorb a good chunk of that heat. And behind those cast iron nubs was the water jacket. And there was, you know, these things were vertical, and there's water in between them, and it, you know, obviously it's circulating around in there. So that's basically how you heated the water inside this box. And then on the top, of course, there was the pipe for the exhaust of the burner, and the boiler box, so to speak, had a pipe going in the bottom of it and a pipe coming out of the top of it, and the pipe going in the bottom of it was the cold water return, and the pipe going out of the top of it was the hot water feed Now, why was the feed on the top and not on the bottom? Well, simple. Heat rises, so the hottest water is on the top of the boiler. So that's what you send out to the building, and that's what you used for heat for the house, or for anything else you wanted to heat. There was also a cover on the side that you could unbolt, and you could bolt into that spot another cover that had a water coil connected to it. And what that was that coil was for your residential hot water. It's called a tankless coil, option or whatever for the boiler. And basically all it is, if you were to pull the thing out, there's two nibs on one side of, two like places where you can attach a screw threaded fitting on the outside of this plate. And then on the inside of those two fittings, there's a copper pipe connected to each of them. It's one piece of copper pipe, and it goes into the boiler, maybe 8 inches, and then it starts turning in loops back towards the this plate, and then it's connected to the other nib. It's just a loop and a big coil in there. And what happens is you connect your cold water to one of those pipes, and the other pipe becomes the hot water for your house. So for your showers and your sinks and whatnot. So with that kind of system, you have to keep the boiler up to temperature all the time. The boiler has to be, like 140, 160 degrees anyway all the time, because anytime you want to use water, the cold water is going to go into the boiler through this coil, and it's going to heat up, and that's how you're going to get your hot water. If the boiler was cold, you would never get any hot water out of the thing. So you had to keep the boiler hot 24 hours a day, which isn't a terribly efficient thing to do. I mean, there's no real reason to keep the boiler hot in the summertime, except for hot water. Now, granted, these are pretty efficient boilers, and they're pretty well insulated. Not wonderfully insulated, but they're pretty well insulated. So the thing maybe ran, unless you're using a ton of water, they might run, a couple times a day. It's not, maybe six times a day. And they would only run for, in Vermont, I remember the thing, it would kick on for like a minute or two and it would shut off. It didn't run very much. It was pretty tight. Pretty efficient. But nonetheless, you did have to have it hot. Now, why did they use the coiler? What coil? Why didn't you just take the water out of the boiler? It's just water, right? Well, that water gets pretty skanky. Because it's in a cast iron boiler to begin with, and the cast iron does tend to rust a bit and leach off some garbage. It's going through all the copper pipes in the house. The water just isn't a good idea to drink. It's just not very clean. So the coil isolates the drinking water from the boiler water and keeps them separate, so the water will always be safe for you to drink and to use for your home. Now, just on the domestic water side for a second, if you have the boiler itself, I'll talk a little bit about controls, but the temperature of the boiler water itself that's inside the boiler can vary. Between the time the boiler just turns off, even in the summer, and the time it turns on, there could be a 20 degree swing. In the winter time, the boiler might actually be running much hotter. Instead of running 140 or 160, it might be up to 180 or 190 in the winter, depending on how much heat you got to get out of it to heat the house. And that's a function of how much heat you need to get out of your baseboards. The hotter the water in the boiler, the hotter the water going through the baseboards, the more heat you're going to get out of them. There's a bigger differential between the room temperature and the water temperature. So it's just like, electric heater. You can have it on low, medium, or high. On low, the coils don't get very hot. On medium, they get a little hotter. On high, they get hottest. And that gives you more and more heat. So you can do the same thing with these coils by cranking the temperature of the water up and down. And I'll talk a little bit about that when I talk about the controls. But, so what I'm saying is, if you have this coil for your hot water, having the temperature of the water in the boiler may be going from 140 or 150, 160, all the way up to maybe 180, 190 degrees. There's too much of a swing there. It's too hard to predict. You could be in the shower and the boiler could kick on and go up 30 degrees. And you could end up having to readjust the valve because the water's getting too hot in the shower. So typically what they'll do is they'll put a mixing valve on the output of that. that takes the hot water out and the and cold water as well, and it'll actually mix the two somewhat automatically to keep that output water temperature at a reasonable range. So a lot of times they have that, it's called a tempering valve. A lot of times they'll have those. So that's another little piece that you'll see on there if you have the in boiler tankless water heater option. And another reason why they do it is just because the water coming out may be really damn hot. I mean, if your boiler is at 180 degrees, you know, the water coming out is going to be, you know, approaching 180 degrees, depending on the volume. So you don't want that going into your showers. It can kill you, literally. So you have the tempering valve that'll kick that 180 degree water down to 120 or 115, something that's safer for you and your family. So you need to have that tempering valve. It's a simple system, but it's at the same time, it's actually more complicated. And the problem, too, with that coil is the you'll never run out of hot water, per se, because the boiler can put out way more heat than you're ever going to get out of that boiler just running hot water, the number of BTUs, typically. I mean, I know my house in Vermont, I could have a sink on, you know, be filling up the laundry machine, have a sink on and be taking a shower, and the boiler would be turning on and off. I mean, it would not be running constantly. So the boiler's putting out way more heat than I'm taking out of it in hot water. So, you know, you don't have to worry about running out of hot water in that regard. But that coil, the faster the water runs through that coil, the less time the water's in the coil getting warmed up. So if you have a high volume pull through that coil, then the output temperature is going to be cooler. Not cold, but it'll be cooler. It just, you know, makes sense. So that's, you know, there's some drawbacks to that system. But it does work, and that's what I had up in Vermont. They worked fine. We never had hot water problems. We always had good hot water. Another problem that does happen, too, is sometimes those coils get full of crap. If you have very hard water, lots of deposits, that iron and stuff will actually start coating the inside of those pipes, effectively insulating them. So after a while, your hot water will be warm because you're just not getting the transfer, especially when you flow more water through it, and you'll have to actually take the coil out and clean it by putting acid in it and letting it sit a little bit and then pouring that crap out or just replacing it or something. So that's another problem with those systems, but I digress. I'm not talking about hot water heaters at this point. So the boiler's got the hot water pipe going out of the top and the cold water return on the bottom. But there's more to the system than just that. Going out of the top in the hot water feed, typically there is a feed attached to that. There's a feed because the boiler is full of water, or it has to be full of water, for it to function. And of course, you need a way to fill the boiler up, correct? I mean, when you first put a new boiler in, it's not full of water. It's empty. It's dry. So you need to be able to get water into it. So they put a, you install on the output pipe, there's a T right near the boiler. And on that T, you know, the big pipe goes up to heat the house, but off that pipe is T'd a little half-inch nub. And that's where you connect up your cold water feed for the boiler. And you put a pressure regulator on it. That's usually they're set for like 15 pounds or 30 pounds, depending on the boiler or whatever. 30, something like that, I don't know, 20 pounds, whatever it is, depending on what it's supposed to be. And the water will flow through that pipe and keep feeding the boiler until the boiler has whatever that preset amount of pressure is. And like I say, it could be 15, 20, 30 pounds, whatever it is. I think the one in Vermont was like 15. It was pretty low pressure. So it would just flow water until it saw 15 pounds behind that little valve, and then it would shut off. It wouldn't let any more water in. And, you know, 15 pounds seems like a pretty low pressure. When you got 50, 60 pounds in the house, you know, why not have more pressure? Well, when you fill it up, the water's cold, and it's a closed system, right? It's got the heating loop, which I'll talk about in a minute. When you turn the boiler on, the water's going to heat up from 50 degrees to, you know, it's going to double or triple in temperature to 100 and something degrees, 150 degrees maybe. And when that happens, the water's going to expand. And when it expands, the pressure is going to go up. And it will go up quite a bit higher than whatever that that little valve is set at. So if you have a 15-pound you know, cutoff, your water pressure might go up to 30 by the time it's heated up. So it'll change that much. It's pretty amazing how much it'll change, actually. So that's why you only bring it up a little bit. I mean, if you were to put 60 or 80 pounds in it, and then the thing heats up, you'd end up having some pretty high pressures in your system. And there's really no need for it. It doesn't need to have that pressure at all. So you got your fills. And then the pipe usually goes up a little bit further. And then as it gets up near the ceiling, it's usually it like it bends off at a 90. And then there's a little tank attached to the top of it, usually. Sometimes it goes upward, sometimes it goes down. But in any case, there'll be a tank there. And then after the tank, there'll be kind of a manifold set up where you'll have all your zones connected, the output to all your zones. And that tank is kind of similar to a little well tank, a little well tank that gives you your water pressure with a little bag in it that I talked about. But this has a reverse effect. What this tank does is allows when the furnace heats up, it allows that water that's heating up and expanding, because remember, hot water expands, it gives that expanding water a place to go. If you didn't have that tank, the water pressure inside the pipes would just build and build and build until the pipes broke. You'd literally split the pipe somewhere. So they put that expansion tank to take up that expansion that's happening when the water heats up. There is also on the top output side somewhere, usually on another T. Sometimes it's usually by the usually it's separate on the boiler. There's another little screw connection, and into that is screwed a pressure relief valve. And the pressure relief valve has a certain setting as well. It could be, 100 pounds or 80 pounds or whatever it is. And you connect a piece of, copper pipe to that, and you bring it down to the ground and put it into a drain if you can. If you don't, you just run it down to the ground. There shouldn't really ever be any water going out of it. You could put a bucket under it in case it drips a little bit or something. But that's a pressure relief valve. So if for some reason the burner, for example, sticks on, let's say the controls go bad and the boiler is just running and running and running and running, what's going to happen? The pressure in the system is going to keep going up and up and up and up. And eventually, the pressure would get so high, as the water got so hot, that the thing would blow up, literally. It would explode. And every now and then you hear of a boiler that explodes. What this relief valve does is it will release that steam pressure and that water, that hot water. It'll release it and keep the pressure in the boiler from getting so hot that it actually explodes. So that thing will actually blow, and you'll have very hot, boiling hot water pouring out of that pipe. And that's why I say you should put it into a drain if you can. But it'll keep the pressure from the boiler getting up too high. They typically have those also on the top of hot water heaters for the same reason. A hot water heater, the pressure will build, and it needs a place for it to go to if it gets too much. And I'll just throw this out there because we're talking about these things. But hot water heaters, if you have a well or city water or something, the cold side of the water heater is usually connected to either the city water connection or it's connected obviously to your well tank, pressure tank, right? And that's the cold side. And the hot side's connected to all, your piping that goes all to your faucets. What happens when you turn your hot water heater on? When the water's cold in the hot water heater and the hot water heater heats up, what happens to the water? I just told you, it's going to expand, just like in the boiler. It's no difference. The water's going to expand a lot. And what's going to happen to the water? Well, it can't go out the hot water side because all the faucets are closed, in theory, unless you're pulling water from it. But chances are you're not going to be pulling water from it. So it's not going to be able to go out the hot water side. So where does it go? It'll actually backfeed into the cold water side. And if you have city water, it'll actually push water out of your house, out into the street again. Which, drinking water, it's okay. Or it'll actually push water back into the water pressure tank, which is okay, because what's that? That's one of those bag deals anyway, and if, you know, every time the water pump turns on, the pressure goes up, so it's no big deal if the hot water heater pushes a little bit of water back into that tank. It's no big deal. So that's the relief for a hot water heater, typically. If for some reason that doesn't work, you also have one of those pressure relief valves that will blow and keep it from building up too much pressure. But why I wanted to bring this up is a lot of new water supplies off city water, a lot of times the codes call for what is called a backflow preventer to be installed at the entrance to the house, basically your water main. And a backflow preventer does just what it says it does. It keeps water from flowing back into the street. And it's a protection device for the city water in case there's any kind of contaminated water in your house from getting back out into the city water system and contaminating the whole system, which could happen. It has happened. And it's mandatory that you have one of those pretty much everywhere if you have sprinklers. Because it's possible, again, that with sprinklers, you know, they're out in the lawn, they're under the dirt, you know, bacteria could grow in those sprinklers. I mean, they're just, you know, it's a buried pipe. I mean, it could get pretty gross, especially if you don't use them very often. If that water were to get into the water mains, it could cause some sickness. So that they always require a backflow preventer in that case. But in a lot of but you also might have a backflow preventer just required by the water company. So just for a normal house, if that's the case, and you turn the hot water heater on, where's that water pressure going to go when the heater builds up pressure? It's not going to go anywhere. And what happens, I saw this on a Bob Vila show, which is one of the things I got out of Bob Vila many years ago, is that they were at a house in Boston, and the thing was leaking out of the pressure relief valve all the time. It was always leaking. And he replaced the valve. He's like, why does this damn thing keep leaking? And the reason was because when the water heated up, it needed a place to go, and the relief valve was just starting to trip a little bit once in a while because of that pressure difference. Now, with a hot water heater, typically the water's hot in the water heater. It heats up to a point, it pretty much stays at that temperature. You might cool it down a little bit when you take your shower, and then it'll heat back up again. So you're not taking like 50 degree water and bringing it to 120. You're taking 120 degree water that's maybe going down to 100 and bringing it back up to 120. So there's not a huge pressure difference there. So it was just dripping a little bit. I suspect if they it was electric hot water heater. I suspect if they lost power and they used up all their hot water and then they turned it on, I suppose they would probably have a lot of water leaking out of that pipe rather than just a little bit. So anyway, so if you have one of those backflow preventers, you need to put one of these little expansion tanks on the top of your hot water heater outlet somewhere too, to be able to take up that expansion. So I'm just putting that out there for general knowledge. So anyway, so you're up near the manifold at the top, the hot water output of the furnace, and you've got that expansion tank. It's like a little gray or blue little tank that hangs from that. Then after that, you're going out to your manifold, and you'll have connections to as many zones as you might have. Now, there's two ways to set up zones for just standard heat. One is to have what are known as zone valves, and one is to have separate circulators. Now, the circulator pump is always put on the return to the boiler. Can anybody figure out why that would be? Yeah, it's just because the water's cooler, I suppose. And it's be a little easier on the little motor and the little impeller. It's just cooler water. It's better, right? So they put them on the return side always. But you can either have one pump in zone valves, or you can have many pumps and no zone valves. It's up to you. In Vermont, I had two zones, and I had two separate circulator pumps. And my thought was, a circulator pump is a mechanical device that can fail, right? It's a little electric motor, and it can burn out. So I figured if I had two of them, if one burned out, I would still have the other. So I would still have some heat in the house. So that's why I went with two circulators, and it probably makes sense. If you have one circulator and zone valves, then if that circulator craps out, you have no heat. So that's, I think, not as good a system, but if you have a lot of zones, it doesn't make the sense to have, you know, six circulator pumps. That's crazy. So it depends on what you're going to do. So a zone, of course, is, I should probably talk about that in case you don't really know what I'm talking about. A zone is a particular area in your house that you want to heat under a separate control. So let's say you have a two-floor house. You might want to have the first floor be one zone and the second floor be another zone. Because at night, you want to keep it upstairs, you know, warm where you go to sleep. But during the day, there's no point in heating the upstairs because you're downstairs, in the kitchen and in the living room and stuff like that. So you might want to separate that. You might have a large bonus room that you don't use all the time. You might want to stick that on a separate zone so you don't have to heat that unless you're going out there. You'll heat it a little bit. Maybe you'll keep it at 60 or something. But when you go out there, you'll crank it up to 68 or 70. So you'll actually save energy by not heating the areas of your house that you're not in. You might want to put a separate zone for each bathroom, just so when you go in there, you can crank the heat up to 75 when you're taking your shower, and you get out and it's nice and toasty warm in there. You might want to do that. I mean, it's up to you, whatever you want to do. But every zone, every different area that you want to heat, you have to be able to control separately with a separate thermostat, and you have to somehow, all you're doing with the thermostat is you're either telling the boiler system to throw some hot water through that baseboard or not. It's all you're doing. So you need to somehow electrically control that water. And like I say, so you can either have a zone valve, which is just a little, it's a little electromagnetic water valve that goes up there. There's like a little green vertical thing. It's just a coil, and when it energizes, it pushes down on a little lever that, you know, opens up a valve. It's basically all it is. And when you turn your thermostat on to call for heat, you're applying some energy to that one valve for that one zone, which opens up the water flow in that zone. And at the same time, you're throwing a relay which turns on the circulator. So if any of the zones open up and need heat, the circulator will kick in. If two or three of these zones are open and on, you know, you still have power to the circulator, so it's still going to turn. So if one zone's on or all of them are on, the circulator just turns on, and the particular zones that are calling for heat will open up the valve, and the water, or some of the water, will flow through that zone and heat up, heat up the rooms. So you have the valves or not, depending on how you're doing it. Like I said, you can have no valves and just have multiple loops and have return circulators on the different loops, and then you're going to be turning circulators on and off individually. Like I had two circulators, and I could turn on, you know, if I turn the basement heat on, the basement circulator would turn on, and the upstairs circulator wouldn't, or vice versa. So that was the other way to control it. So you can either do it with valves or with separate circulators. So from there, the water leaves the boiler. There's one other thing that I had to install in my house in Vermont, because a funny thing was happening. And I forget. I'm pretty sure these were put up there on the hot water side. I don't think they were on the... they weren't on the returns. I think they were on the hot water side. But I had an interesting phenomena. I would have my thermostat off in the basement, but the heat, some of the radiators were always warm. They would always be warm, even though the heat was turned off. And it was actually kind of nice. It was very warm, but it was wasteful. So I called in my heating guy, and I said, what the heck's going on? The circulator's off, but it's still warm. And can anybody guess what was going on? What was happening is I was having, because remember I had separate circulators, I didn't have the zone valves. What was happening is I had a natural convection. The water was heating up. It was rising out of the boiler. It was going through some of the pipes and into a radiator and cooling and then sinking and then coming back around and back into the boiler. And it was a natural convection flow of the water. So what he did is he put this little, it's a little valve deal that won't open unless a significant amount of pressure is pushed on it. I mean, not significant, it was like maybe you need like 5 or 10 pounds of pressure, water pressure, before it would open, otherwise it would shut. So it was enough that when the circulator turned on, it made enough pressure to open it up, no problem. But the natural convection of the system was nowhere near enough pressure flow to open up the valve. So that stopped that immediately. So that was kind of neat. He put a couple of those in. He just cut them in. It took him 5 minutes. So you might want to put those on if you're doing a system. But, you know, my other zone never did that. It was only one zone that did it, just because of the way it was hooked up and the way it was run, I guess. So from there, the pipes go out to your various through your various radiators. So let's say you're doing the first floor. That pipe may go... it depends on your house and where your boiler is and everything else. It doesn't really matter where you start or where you end. The radiators are all going to be pretty much the same temperature. I mean, I suppose the first radiator that gets the water is probably going to be a little bit hotter than the last radiator, but it's not really much of a difference. So the water will leave the boiler, and it will travel through a piece of 3/4-inch copper pipe over to your first radiator, and it'll go in one end and out the other. And from there, that pipe, that the output of that first radiator will be connected to the input of the second radiator, wherever that is. So the pipe will go through the basement a little bit, and then it'll pop up into a room somewhere and be connected to another radiator. And it'll go through that radiator, and then it'll come out, or baseboard, I'm talking, it's really baseboard radiator, not a big antique one, although you could use those if you had them. They're just not, again, not as efficient. The second baseboard radiator would then, you know, feed the water back down into another pipe that would go to the third baseboard radiator, etc., until you got to the last one, and then it would run back to the return on the boiler through a circulator pump. Again, either a common circulator pump or the one that's individually made for that circuit. It would go back into the boiler, somewhat cooler than it left at the top, right? It would go into the bottom of the cooler, at bottom of the boiler, and it would be reheated by the burner. And it would come back out the top again, hot again, and go out through all your loops. That's basically how it works. It's not terribly complicated. If you want to put one of these in yourself, you certainly can. It's plumbing, basically. You're sweating pipes for all the baseboard radiators, and there's some tricks to doing it. There's some special fittings you have to use. You have to put bleeder valves in some places, because when you first start up the system and start filling up the boiler, you're going to fill the boiler up, which is fine, but all the loops in the house are all going to be full of air, and you've got to get the air out of the loops, otherwise the pipes clang and bang and make all kinds of noise. A system that's full of water is virtually silent when it operates. But if there's any water in the pipes, you'll hear the radiators will be gurgling. And I'm sure you've all heard that in movies and stuff, Archie Bunker or whatever. You'll hear the pipes all gurgling. That's because there's air bubbles in the pipes. And, I forgot to mention one other thing that's on the top side, too. Up there, it's usually part of at least the one I was, the one I had at my house was, anyway, actually both of them were. That output pipe from the boiler goes into a great big what they call an air scoop, and usually the expansion tank is connected to the bottom of the air scoop. And what the air scoop does is anytime it's any air goes through that air scoop, it'll take the air out of the water if there's like an air bubble. And it'll actually vent it. There's actually a little valve, and it'll actually vent the air into the basement. So, if you just filled up the boiler and turned on the circulator pump, for example, if there was enough to get some water flowing through those pipes, as it flowed through, if there was an air pocket that came out of the boiler, which you know there is inevitably when you first turn it on, the air would get up to that air scoop and it would be bled off. And it would let the water go through the loop, and the air would blow off. So I forgot about the air scoop. I'm sorry, folks. So that's another little piece that's there. But you can hook this up yourself. I mean, when you buy a boiler, they give you the dimension, they give you the directions, and they show you a picture of how it should be hooked up. You can also go over to a friend's house and see how it's hooked up there, take a picture of theirs or something. It's not terribly complicated, but there's a lot of plumbing involved. There's a lot of fittings, a lot of pieces and parts, and to do a nice job and to make it neat, it's a bit of work, you know. It's not that simple. There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of plumbing involved. But again, it's doable. I think I could put one in. I never have, I've always had them put in, but I think I could do it if I had to do it. It's not, especially now I have a lot of confidence in doing plumbing. I would probably be able to do it and do it just fine. Now, the other part of this whole puzzle, of course, is the controls. The controls can be pretty simple, analog type, relay type controls, or they can be very sophisticated electronic controls, depending on your furnace and how high tech it is. Now, on the most basic side, you have basically an aquastat, which is a thermostat that takes the temperature of water, aquastat, temperature thermostat. And that thing's stuck into the side of the boiler, and it keeps the boiler water at a particular range that you set. As my one in Vermont was very low tech. It had a low set and a high, it had a low cutoff and a high cutoff. A low cut in and a high cutoff, and you'd set it. So whatever. You would turn on at 140 and off at 160 or whatever. It would just do that all day, and it didn't care about nothing else. Once the water in the boiler got to the low temp, it would turn on, and when it got to the high temp, it would shut off. Period, end of story. Didn't matter what anything else was going on. And then also there was some controls for the circulators, which basically was pretty simple. I mean, it was a place to tie the thermostat in, which runs off 24 volts, and that in return through some relays and stuff that turned the circulator on and off. Or it could turn the could also turn the zone valves on and off if you had those. They pretty much usually run on 120 volts, same kind of voltage. No, I take that back. Actually, the circulators run on 120, but the zone valves, I think, run on 24. But anyway, it's you have a control that does that depending on how you want to do it. More sophisticated controls will actually look at the temperature outside. They're called reset controllers or zero reset controllers or something. Anyway, they look at the outside temperature. And that will actually vary the temperature of the boiler. So if it's 50 degrees out, it's going to keep the temperature of the boiler fairly low because you really don't need heat. So you'll save oil that way. It won't be heating the boiler up to very high temperatures. It'll keep it up high enough to make your hot water and stuff, but it's not going to heat it up to the highest temperature to get the most heat out of the radiators. Baseboards, but when it gets to be 20 degrees below zero, it's going to tell that boiler to crank hot because we need a lot of heat because it's very cold. It's going to make the boiler run at the highest temperature so you get the most heat out of the baseboards. So those are called reset controls, a little bit more complicated. Some of these, and then of course some of the boilers have even more high tech controls. I'm not going to get into them, but depending on the number of zones and stuff like that, they can get very, very complicated. So again, that depends on the boiler. So that's kind of your basic boiler. Now they have some new high tech type boilers that I saw. Burnham makes one actually, and there's some other companies that make them. And basically, they're a tankless water heater type boiler. And they have an inlet and an outlet. It's a little box you hang on the wall. It looks like a Rinnai hot water heater. It's a little box you hang on the wall. And it's got a little oil burner in it, and they make these in gas, too. We'll talk about gas burners in a second, but it looks like a little teeny miniature boiler. I mean, it's got there's a little inlet pipe to it, there's an outlet pipe to it. You have to hook up an expansion tank up to it, just like you do a normal boiler, but the thing has zero water. I mean, it has like maybe a quart of water in it or something like that. And as soon as you need heat, this thing turns on and immediately starts to heat up. And then it immediately starts to pump the hot water out of the unit. It's basically an instantaneous hot water heater. But instead of heating your water, domestic water, it's heating radiators. It's the same thing. And they're really, really cool. And because there's no water involved, there's hardly any water in there. It doesn't take nothing to get the things going. And they only run when they're needed. So they're very, very efficient. And they're really, really cool little machines. And usually they're in gas. Most of these things are gas, but I do believe Burnham made a, I think I saw Burnham made an oil one now. I don't know. They're coming out with new stuff all the time. With oil getting expensive, they keep coming out with these new gizmos. So that's something to look at. That's really, especially in gas, they have them. They're very, very efficient. They're talking 90, I think I saw one was like 98 or 99% efficient, which means all the heat coming out of the fuel is getting into that water. It's amazing. And I should talk a little bit about efficiencies because they're all rated in, you know, 87% or 85% or whatever. And that's simply the amount of heat that you're getting out of the oil and how much of it's getting into the water and how much of it's going up the smokestack. So your older ones, you know, a lot of the heat went up the smokestack because they weren't very good at extracting the heat out of the flame like they are now. So that's kind of the new high-tech boilers. In addition, instead of heating up a baseboard, you can also heat up the floor. It's called radiant heat, and you can do it with pretty much any kind of floor. A lot of people do it with, like, tile floors. If you have a garage, you can heat your cement floor up. You can heat up wood floor even. You can put underneath the floor, you know, between the stud bays, you can attach this pipe to the bottom. And what you do is you run warm water through the pipes, not 180 degree water, but you would run maybe 100 degree water or something like that. And what it does is it runs for a long time, but it just heats up the floor a little bit, and the floor being warm will heat the room up eventually. And it's a really cool system. You walk around with bare feet and the floors feel nice and warm, and it just makes you feel really warm. It's a nice system, but it's kind of expensive to put in because you got to run all these pipes through all the floor. And then, of course, there's the issue of the pipes ever leak. They're in your floor, so you got to tear your floor up to fix it. So it's a little bit more expensive and stuff, but it's an awfully neat system, and more people are doing it. Now, with these systems, they're a little bit more complicated because you can't put the output of a boiler into one of these things because the water would be just too hot. It would actually dry out your floor, crack the concrete. I mean, you can't put 180 degree water through concrete. It's not going to like that. You have to gradually warm it up and then gradually cool it off. And you do that by putting, you know, just water that's warm but not really hot. So they have to have either mixing valves or something like that. And those really high-tech, you know, Rinnai water heater type boilers that I was talking about, those are really well suited for this because they can just heat the water a little bit. You can program those so the water going out of that thing is whatever temperature you want it to be. And it'll just modulate the flame the flame for the unit to put out that amount of heat necessary to get the water up to the temperature that you want. So those are really pretty cool systems. I'll try and get somebody on here to interview to talk a little bit more about these. I'm not really, really familiar with them like they are. But they're really cool. I am really familiar with the Rinnai though, because I have one, and I'll talk about one of those when we talk about hot water heaters, which I'll probably do pretty soon here because it's kind of part of the heating system, so to speak. Now, with those in the floor systems, like I say, there's a little bit more control involved. A lot of people have a lot of different zones. A lot of times they're using the PEX type tubing, so they have zones all over the place. Those systems get kind of complicated sometimes, but they are really neat. It's something to look into if you want to do that. And sometimes people will just do one or two rooms that way, and they'll do the rest with base. You know, like they'll do the bedrooms with normal baseboard, but they might put the radiant in the master bath, and maybe they'll put it in the kitchen, in the dining room, in the living room, or something like that. And maybe the husband will put it out in the garage. That's sweet. I mean, trying to change the oil with the floor nice and warm. Oh, so nice. Never, you know, nice and everything's. You get down here to work on the car and the floor is warm. That's sweet if you're into fixing cars. Just nice to be there. You're not cold. Usually, you know, even if you have a burner, something, a furnace or something in your garage, the floor is always cold and miserable to be next. It's damp and miserable. You know, even being on a creeper or something, it's always cold under the car. But the concrete's warm. It's not anymore. So it's kind of nice. But something to think about. But anyway, if you like putting around outside and doing that kind of thing, I don't even have heat in my garage, so whatever. But I guess if you're rich, you might want to do that. Or if you just do a lot of work on your cars, it might be worth it. So that's kind of you know, boilers in you know, 10 minutes or less. Although it's probably been close to an hour here. 58 minutes. Yeah, I don't think I'm even gonna do hot air tonight. I'll do it tomorrow. But that's boilers in a glance. It boilers, just some advantages while I'm at it. Advantages are that the systems are very efficient these days. The baseboards, it's a silent system. You really can't hear it when it's running. You might hear the furnace running, the boiler running in the basement, but pretty much it's silent. It's a nice, slow, gentle heat. Typically, that the baseboards will be on for a longer time than like a warm air furnace will. So the room heats up a little slower, and then the baseboards cool off a little slower. So it's a little bit more of a gradual heat, a little bit more of a steady heat. It's really, I think it's the best kind of heat there is. It's not as much a dry heat, or so people say. It, you know, hot air furnaces tend to dry the air out a little bit more, just because of the way they work. You're running the air next to a very hot heat exchanger, and I guess that dries it out more. I don't know. I don't understand it, but baseboard supposedly doesn't do that as much. So it's nice that way. I guess downsides is I'm not sold that it is as efficient as warm air. I think warm air is a little bit more efficient because of simple physics. You're taking the oil or the gas and you're heating the air. It's a direct deal. With water, you're taking the oil or the gas and you're heating up water, and then the water is heating up the air. So I think just going from the different from one form to the next form, you know, three times, I think three different heating mediums, from the flame to the water to the air, I think is versus just from the flame to the air, I think is a little bit less efficient. I may be wrong on that. I don't know. I'm really, really impressed with this furnace that we have now, the hot air furnace we'll talk about in the next show. I'm very, very impressed with that unit. I don't know if you can get that kind of efficiency out of a baseboard. But the nice thing about baseboard heat is it's pretty easy to zone. With warm air, you have the big ducts, and you can zone it. We have three zones in our house. You can zone it with valves, but you got all these big ducts going all over the place. And if you have like a bonus room that's off to the side somewhere or something, you have to run all these big ducts out there to get the air out there. If you have baseboard heat, you're running 2 3/4-inch pipes out. It's very small, very, very small little thing to run out to that room, and you put your baseboards in and you get your heat. So remote areas can be heated very easily with baseboard. If you have a sprawling ranch, L or U-shaped house with screwy additions off it and stuff like that, much easier to heat with hot water. I mean, all you need to do is get two little pipes out there and you got hot water. With air, you got to get all these ducts, you know, and you got to run them through the room before, especially if you don't have a basement. It's just, you know, hot water definitely has its advantages. It's a pretty neat system, but it's a little bit more complicated because you do have all these pipes and all these fittings and pumps and all this other stuff, and it is more expensive, I believe, to put a hot water-based system in than to put an air system in, because the ductwork for hot air is just cheap and easy to put in. So, you know, and the boilers, I think, cost more than furnaces do, hot air furnaces, because it's just, again, there's more to them. They're a little bit more complicated. They got to deal with the water. It's the heavier. You know, a furnace is nothing but, you know, sheet metal, basically, these days. They're really pretty cheap, versus a boiler usually has some cast iron to it and stuff. So it's just a different beast. However, a boiler, longevity-wise, will probably outlast a furnace. If boilers, they're cast iron, they pretty much don't go bad. I mean, nothing, you know, they'll get outdated and, they'll get more efficient ones out there and stuff. But they really don't go bad. It's not like with a hot air furnace, eventually the heat exchanger burns out in a lot of cases. The one we have is stainless steel. It should last forever. But you know, a lot of these furnaces don't have stainless steel heat exchangers. And eventually the flames hitting and getting hot and cold, eventually they'll start getting holes in them. They'll just basically burn out, and then you have to replace them. So I don't think furnaces are going to last as long as a boiler. Having said that, again, the one in my father's house lasted 30 years. But that thing was a boat anchor. That thing was huge. That furnace was 4 feet square and 6 feet high. My furnace is maybe a foot and a half by foot and a half by 3 feet. Something like that. It's literally a third or a quarter the size, and you know, so it's you know, everything's changed. I mean, from then till now. So but I definitely encourage you to look around, because there's some really, really cool systems out there now for heating your house. So with that, I'm going to sign with you, and in the next podcast, I'll talk a bit about warm air heat and how that works, and then we'll get probably start talking about fuels as well, because I don't think the warm air segment's gonna take as long, but I didn't think this one would take as long either. So anyway, thanks for listening to this, the Homeowner's Friend Podcast, the podcast that will help you achieve the American dream and live the best life you can, even on a rice and beans budget. Thanks, folks. Take care. Drop me an email. Let me know how things are going. Bye-bye. Home on the blues.
Well, man's home is his castle. This one's just a hassle. Home on the blues.